This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hey everybody, it's Aaron Norris with the Norris Group. Today we are joined, and I get to interview Bruce Norris, of course, CEO of the Norris Group, and then Andrea Jennings, who is an award-winning realtor. Currently with, you're with McKee Real Estate right now. I know that name. I went to school with Ryan. Over the years, she's worked with buyers, sellers, and even investors. She started her career in the early 90s and began working with Bruce in 1993. And from 96 to 2002, she had owned and operated her own successful real estate business. And during this last downturn, she joined the dark side as an investor and work both as a realtor and investor. So welcome to the show. And today is a little bit different. We're going to be renovating buying systems. I first came onto the Norris Group back in 2005 with two goals. Number one was to back in the Norris Group into a California only company with your market timing report, the California crash, 400 pages, 1,000 charts, 2 days of nothing but charts. Mind numbing is great. Followed up by the California Only Investor Series, which ended up being over 1,200 pages, 44 CDs worth of 40 hours of how-to information of your entire career put on paper. So a decade later, things have changed. So the one thing we didn't get to do in the buying systems is go through each buying strategy, and there are 24, talking about how it changes by quadrant. And technology has definitely changed some of those things. So we're going to cover that today. So if you've never been to one of our education events, it's important to understand the quadrants. And you can always go to the norrisgroup.com/freemium. And if you register there, you have access to a few free chapters, chapter 6 in Investor Essentials and Buying Systems chapter 1. But really quick to frame the conversation, quadrant 1 is moving from a hot market to a flat market. So a good example of the last downturn would be 2006 to 2007, would you say?
Quadrant four.
Quadrant one. So
it's the flat market.
Right, correct. And then quadrant two, from a flat market to a bust market.
Right.
So 07 to 2008, roughly.
2011.
Well,
lasted a while.
Okay, well, Q3, quadrant three is a bust to a flat market. So what would you consider those years?
It's the flat market. It's the little piece in between the upside. And so it's the downturn has ended. So you have quadrant three is a flat.
Okay.
Quadrant four begins this long rise.
Right.
So the two quadrants that have lengthy years are two and four.
Okay.
The transitions are one and three.
Right. And in this last cycle, quadrant one was short and painful then.
Well, and the timing of that is really important because if you're holding the wrong inventory at the end of quadrant four and quadrant one hits, land.
Yeah.
One bedroom condos. It changed like right now.
Well, and the buying strategies change really quickly as well. So I think that's something unique that we bring to the market. So let's dig in. How did the two of you meet?
Actually, Andre was very instrumental in me even creating the buying systems and all the things because what happened, I was, for the 80s, I was running ads in the newspaper buying 100% of whatever I was buying directly from people. And then around 1990, my ad calls doubled off the same ad, and my purchases went down by 90%. And I was feeling like I was a counselor instead of an investor because everyone was upside down. And it was awful. And then I remembered, this looks like some other time I experienced. And it was then when I started seeing the HUD auctions start happening. And then I thought, I need access to the MLS. And you ran a really good ad, Andre. I remember reading the ad, and I said, that is a really cool ad. And so I called her, and then we met, and I didn't have access to the MLS. And so I think we had books at the time.
Yeah, what's interesting is when Bruce and I met was we were just transitioning from the MLS books to a system that was the original system called Lightning.
Okay.
Lightning.
It was called Lightning. And
it probably wasn't.
True.
And it was on paper.
And that's really how we first started with the buying system was, you know, looking through the information and your data. Remember, it was back when we printed with the perforated pages. And your dad said, print everything in this price range and give it to me. And it was a stack, like several inches. And he went through every one of them. And then called me and he faxed me over a list and there was probably 15 properties on that list. And he said, I want to write an offer on every one of these. And that's how we started.
But see, I knew the deals had flown somewhere, but it, like, who moved my cheese book was perfect. So my cheese moved, but I had no idea how to access them. And then I remembered, wait a minute, this is reminding me of a past time. But I hadn't coordinated that in a sequence. Mm-hmm. So I was starting to be in quadrant two, but I didn't recognize what I was supposed to do yet. Mm-hmm. And so when we got access to the MLS, I was seeing these listings going, oh my gosh.
That's where they
there
went.
There it is, man. There's a 70 grand house that they're asking 35 grand for. And of course, when it hit the paper, we call up and it was already pending. And so then we said, okay, what do we have to do? And so then three times a day, she would send me the hot sheets by fax. And I mean, the next sound you hear is my car start. Because remember, we even had pre-written the offers.
Yes.
All we had to fill in was the address, and boom,
and the price.
We were done. And it was really a first game. In other words, if you were first, you probably were going to get it.
Well, and this has changed a lot because of technology, too. So System 1 in the buying systems is buying properties through the MLS first day only. So
right.
Going from paper and faxes to now, you know, setting up automatic, immediate notifications when something gets listed and being able to get really granular
on
what
right.
you're looking for.
You can say, here's what I want, and boom, you and 100 or maybe 1,000 other people are simultaneously going to get it. That doesn't still it doesn't negate the value of number one. Okay, a lot of people think it's for chasing properties. It's not. It's for chasing relationships.
Very important difference.
it's one at a time at a property, but you capture an agent who has a clientele that he can say, you know, there's a world where you can get a check within a week and it's not all that bad. You paid 28 grand for this house. It's now worth 400. You got it in a probate or a will. In other words, you didn't pay anything for it. Would you like to just leave with the check? That world exists constantly. Mm. But the capturing the agent, you find that agent that's able to list properties below market pretty quickly through the first day MLS. The problem is it's usually pending. And that means somebody's in place. Okay.
So are you looking for an agent that also prices it right out of the gate?
Absolutely.
Got it.
That's what number one does. Okay. That's
what
system
does
number
you?
One. It tells me they have motivated sellers, and maybe that's a niche. So then you start finding out, well, it depends on what quadrant. And if you're in quadrant two, invariably they're dealing with short sales and then they're dealing with REOs. Well, that's great because they're going to be dealing with that probably for years. So the agent relationship is much more important than that property. I'd rather capture the agent and lose the property any day.
Okay. Well, let's go back real quick and talk about you. When you met Dad, what'd you think? And why did you decide to work with this guy?
Yeah, because you weren't working with investors and you were really new.
Yeah, I feel really fortunate that I met Bruce because I was only licensed for about a year when I met Bruce. And I was working in an office that had a lot of old-time agents, and they had a really negative attitude toward investors.
Sharks.
Mm-hmm. And I remember Bruce walking in and talking to me and telling me what he did. And I was really receptive and open to the idea. And I thought, this is great.
You didn't know any better.
Well, I thought, you know, okay. And the fantastic thing was working with him was he had a reputation of, you know, closing deals and, you know, not going out and writing an offer and then changing his mind or wanting to renegotiate. And those are all really key factors in today's market as well.
Sure.
Mm. So when we started working together, it was fantastic. Your dad was out looking at the properties and he was faxing or calling saying these are what he wanted offers written on. And we created that first day buying system that worked really well for a long time.
It also, I remember the auction. This was a fun day for me because I was at an auction and a lot of people knew who I was already. But people kept coming by, and this is your first time at an auction with
right.
me. And people kept going, coming by and saying, hey, Bruce, you know, she finally looks at me, Andrea, and goes, who are you?
I did.
It was kind of funny.
That is funny.
But, you know, as an investor, and I know we're getting off the first day.
That's okay.
That taught me so much about how to be a good investor and to be the investor that your dad was talking about relationships mm-hmm. that agents will call. Because they know when they get into escrow with me, I've already seen the property. I've already done my due diligence. I'm not going to renegotiate and I'm going to close. And those are all things I learned, you know, from Bruce. And that's really key in this business and having those relationships.
Do you see that still happening a lot wearing your agent hat, people locking something up, writing an offer, and they've just never even been inside the property?
I have one in escrow right now that I'm flipping that's how I got the property. I was the second highest offer on it. It was an out of area agent. And I just said, I don't know how these numbers would even make sense for a flipper. And they went out and saw the property after they had locked it up and went back and wanted to renegotiate. And this agent kicked them out, called me.
Nice.
And she just told him, I don't need to work with you. I've already got somebody else who's seen the property. And I bought it and we closed 10 days later. So it really is about, you know, doing your due diligence and writing a strong offer and conveying to that agent on the other end that you are going to close and not give them any issues.
And you want the next one.
Right.
See, that's the most important thing that happened is not that property purchase, but that connection. Mm-hmm. So that lady now knows, okay, well, and I have one of these again. And that, whatever that is, it was a buying system. Mm-hmm. So whatever produced that deal is really a buying system. And that's why I always asked, how did you come by that property? And invariably, it was a buying system. It was somebody was in a probate or somebody was in foreclosure or somebody, it was a repetitive theme. And maybe this agent pursued that repetitive theme as their niche. So their farm was, if you're behind in payments, if you're in a probate, if you're whatever, mm-hmm. okay, well, that was great. I didn't have to do that. I don't understand a lot of what's going on right now because there's a lot of people that want to wear all the hats. They don't want any team members. They want to find the property themselves. So they spend 10 grand a month in mailers. Mm-hmm. They want to fund their own deals. So they deal with all the private parties directly. And I guess it's competitive. So their margins are so slim. That's what they have to do. But I think there's other people that I know that don't do any of that and have bigger margins.
Right.
And they're doing what they do best. They're finding properties instead of wearing all these hats to eliminate costs. And they're the people that are doing less are making more.
Yeah, I take two calls still, unfortunately, too often. One is, I just locked up a property. I need to go see it. Can you fund? Here are the numbers. I'm all, how are you giving me numbers if you've never seen the inside of the property? I'm all, you're about to shoot yourself in the foot if this is from the MLS. And they're like, why? So they haven't even thought about the process. And unfortunately, the other one is a lot of the national gurus are back doing the big seminars. And my favorite call is like, I'm going to get in foreclosures and all these REOs. And I literally walk them through the process of, let's go to Bank of America REO. I'm like, look from Riverside. They're like, there's four. It's changed. You've been told the wrong information and this is what you're up against. So it's unfortunate those two conversations are still happening way too frequently.
Well, I'll give you an example. In the boot camps that we used to have, one of the several hours we spent was really to get a negative response on a thing that they thought was going to be good. Call the lender directly and avoid dealing with the agents. Okay, well, let's spend 2 hours doing that. And at the end of those 2 hours, everybody was going, that was terrible. They don't want to talk to us. Exactly.
Right. Because they have a team together already that they know is going to list, market, and sell the property.
Become the first person on that team. Be the person they want to call first. You don't have to deal with the lenders. You don't want to deal with the lenders.
So just briefly, because I think it's pretty clear that the technology piece has really changed. It's the immediate. I mean, how often are you getting offers when you list something on the MLS?
Well, technology has really changed because Zillow offers a coming soon feature. And a lot of agents use that coming soon because a lot of agents want to double in their properties.
Why not?
Exactly. So instead of it even being in the MLS, they've put it onto the Zillow coming soon. They're already creating that buyer pool and looking at the property. The other thing is Facebook. A lot of agents are putting their properties on Facebook with the coming soon or we have this now and are selling their properties off market. But I think you're looking at two different things. We're looking at a property that's, you know, an end user property versus a property that Bruce and I would buy that has no kitchen and the pool is empty. And
that's true. Okay, that's fair.
You know, that's more of the relationship driven that we're talking about because agents that have those properties want to work with an investor that's going to close.
Yeah, because they know.
Right, they know. And especially if they're a bank REO, you know, because their performance is tracked. How close were they to their BPO price? How many days was it on market? And if it's a regular, you know, agent, and we've been doing a lot of probates lately, you know, we have heirs who are wanting to get their cash out of this property and they want it to close and they don't want to be in a 30 or 45 day escrow.
They don't want to fix anything.
And they don't want
they
to
just
fix
want
anything.
Out.
And they may be from a distance. Now, are you pursuing probates then? How is that happening?
Recently, I have. I actually went and took a class on how to purchase probates and how to find them because I do think that's a great niche. The last couple of flips we've done have been listed, but were probate properties.
Every time I heard from Gene Devine years ago, that was what it was. It was a probate.
It is. And again, you know, like the one that we just bought, this was a brother that had passed away. A sister inherited the house. It was a mess. She wanted nothing to do with that house. She wanted it
And she also has no capacity to deal with it. She can't hire contractors and get to the finish line safely. There's no way.
That's true. And then they're sometimes dealing with siblings and complicated family situations. So sometimes they just want out.
Exactly.
Yeah. I've been hearing a lot of those stories lately, too.
You know, I think one of the things that's lost is everyone that wholesales houses makes that decision every day. When you sell something, you're not saying, you're saying, I don't want retail. I want a check. I want it to be fast. Mm-hmm. And I'm leaving some on the table for you. That's, in other words, we get it. There's times where that's really a benefit. Not 100% of the time, but a certain percentage of the time, especially when it's a gifted house, does it really matter if you get 100% minus closing costs, minus repairs, and months of time devoted, or do you just want to check where maybe it's 10% or 15% less than you would have possibly gotten going through all of that? The answer is a lot of times, yeah, it is.
Yeah, two different skill sets, finding the properties and then taking it through the very end. Not always the same skill set. That's why I'm a buy and hold guy. Flips make my stomach hurt.
Well, I definitely will say after doing it now for a little bit, it's nerve-wracking. I'm not going to lie. You get up in the mornings and you're just like, okay, you know, we better be right. We better have done the right numbers.
The other part of exciting is closing them. I remember days where we were supposed to have 7 closings. I'm not, you aren't connected to the sales side, but, you know, and we'd have 1 closing and I'd have enough money come out of that to make the payments on the hard money loans for the 20 I had that were waiting to close. It's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's stressful. Ugh. Well, let's go through the quadrants. So quadrant one is sort of a fast sort of in between a boom and a bust cycle.
Yeah, it's that calm period where everybody's trying to pretend it's still okay.
So on the MLS... agents are listing these properties as prices are sort of flattening out. And what's the mood? Are people in denial?
Yeah. Denial's the very first thing. Absolutely. From my perspective,
right.
Is that you just had this great run. Everything you touch turned to gold. And of course it's going to continue and it's taking a pause. Charts don't usually do that because what happens in quadrant one is you have a rise of foreclosures and you have a rise of inventory and you have a stopping of sales and price increases. So all of a sudden these defaults convert to trusty sales that convert to REOs, and then the mix changes radically and the REOs start dictating what the number is, not the fixed house.
Right.
And that happens. And as soon as that happens, you're in quadrant two, but you're inevitably going from quadrant one to quadrant two.
Right.
And some things happen really quickly with dirt, let's say land. Mm-hmm. Becomes very unpopular. So if you have land for sale, it's not going to sell. And at the very best, it's going to get an option to somebody to buy it. And they're going to string it out and see if it's going to work. And usually they fall out of escrow. So there's just some things that happen. Mobile homes, everything that's okay in quadrant four because you rationalize it at the end of it. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's a one bedroom studio condo. But hey, at least I get to own something. It's a mobile home on a dirt road. That's okay. None of that's okay in quadrant two, and it changes really fast.
Right. Okay. And the agent at that point is also probably trying to realistically deal with the sellers that aren't understanding what's transpiring. And they're like, no, it's worth $700,000. It's about to be worth $500,000.
Right. And that was the 06 to the 07 market.
Right.
I don't know. Your dad could say much better what happened in 07, but it literally went from 06 being here to 07. The banks were not realistic at all about what their properties were worth, and buyers simply were not going to buy.
Yeah. Well, first of all, lots of people had borrowed a lot of money, so the buyers were upside down. Everybody had a big loan and had refied money out, and then they started losing their credit. So the buyer pool, at the worst case, I'm trying to think of the year exactly, but I think it was 2009. Mm-hmm. Something like 75% of transactions in Riverside were REO and short sale, which means 75% of the time, a close of escrow didn't replicate a buyer going forward,
right?
Which was completely ridiculous. So you had this big hole, you had this large amount of REOs showing up, and there were only cash buyers to take it off the table. And that was sort of pre 2007 and 8 were pre hedge funds,
right?
It was private people. And there were 50 listings in San Bernardino for every $1,000 price increment.
I remember that, pulling those lists. So, okay, so in quadrant one, investors in the first day MLS, probably maybe it's better time spent building those relationships with the agents who are going to be focused on short sales and REOs.
There's no doubt about that. As a matter of fact, one of the things that started to happen is in, say, 2005, when we wrote the report, you'd have Michael Novak-Smith in the audience.
How do you spot those agents that look like they're going to go down that route?
They've been there before.
Right.
This is repeat history.
Okay. Right?
So who was Michael Novak Smith before that? An REO agent.
Right.
And Steve Silva and on and on.
Right.
It's repetitive. Matter of fact, when that cycle started, I got calls from people that were doing it in the 90s. Are you still in? That was the question. They wanted to know if I can send you stuff like I used to 10 years ago.
Wow.
So that's how long those relationships last.
As well as your reputation.
Right. Well, you won't get that call if they didn't find that was good.
Okay. So quadrant two, the bust. The REO agents and short sales start to really start landing on the MLS. And that's really changed too. So technology, yeah. A lot of the banks have forced agents to basically just have a board. Here are all the properties. And they're really looking at the net, right? After so many, like, how does that work? After so many not closing, are they finally giving investors, you know, a chance? Like, what did that look like?
Well, I think one of the things that you have to look at is, you know, Fannie and HUD have what they call their first look time periods.
Right.
So, you know, they're wanting to keep those properties for the buyer pool that's going to be an owner-occupant. So those type of properties, you know, they go through the first look period, and then they're open to investors to be able to bid on. As far as regular inventory is concerned, again, we're talking about a property that if it doesn't have a kitchen or the pool is empty, those just aren't going to get the financing. So it's about them being realistically priced.
One of the best things that happened for investors was the city got the capacity to find homes.
Oh, wow. And it was different at every city. So in the city of Riverside, it could be up to like $100 per day per fine.
I thought it was 1,000.
Oh, maybe it was a limit. I forget.
It was 1,000. Well, I remember you had a listing, and I think it was in San Bernardino, where the fines were greater than the listing price by a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
So the lender was selling it and writing a check, getting paid off a little bit and having to pay off the city lien of $80,000.
Well, in this cycle, the city's also got the neighborhood stabilization fund. So all of a sudden they were competing with investors being able to buy the worst of the worst, even if they were overpaying for it. It wasn't money that they had to worry about. They were just getting it. And they couldn't end up spending a lot of their money fast enough.
What's interesting is I don't know that we're ever going to see that glut of foreclosures dealt with the old-fashioned way and caused great price damage. It seems like, you know, there's a learning curve. So the technology curve is also matched with, okay, what did we do that was successful? And it's oddest thing, like Nevada, they just said, let's don't foreclose. So you had people living in their house for 4 or 5 years without making a payment. They were upside down by so far. The lenders didn't want to touch it. They'd lose 80%. So you created a housing shortage, literally, to where the builders came in and built stuff for retail and everybody's prices rose. And all of a sudden you're going, is that the new method?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're a lender, do you want to take a 70 or 80% hit, which happened in Moreno Valley? I was buying properties at $60,000 that was going for 360, and the loan was 360. So they were getting almost an 80% or more haircut. And or do you just say, you know what, I'm going to consider it a straight note for 4 or 5 years and get 280 for it? Well, if you think about that, that's an interesting thing. But you need the cooperation of the powers that be, because in about 95, there was a dip in foreclosures, but there was an increase in NODs. And what happened is the lenders said, we're not foreclosing on them.
Right.
And they enacted a law that said within 100 days of being late, you have to.
And then it forced their hands.
So they had to foreclose, and the peak happened, and you had the worst year in 97. But this time, the lates and the NODs went through the roof, and the trustee sales went down because they just said, the heck with it.
And in 08, this down cycle, they even tried to incentivize buyers with an $8,000 tax credit, correct?
Right.
That's correct.
And it worked. I mean, it did work in the sense, but what happened is you brought forward buyers into that year. And when the $8,000 disappeared, then you really had the buyer pool that was so damaged credit-wise and mood-wise. And that's the one thing you don't have a chart for. What's the psyche damage when you have literally a Great Depression in an industry take out housing values to such an extent that you thought you were safe at 50% equity and now you're upside down? I mean, that is bizarre.
Well, we're out of time for this segment, and so we're going to have to carry it over to segment two because we still have another strategies to cover as well, but it's all right. I know the second one is going to be a little bit shorter, but if they want to get a hold of you, Andrea, how can they find you?
Well, that would be great if they'd like to give me a call.
Okay, of course, yeah.
My phone number, 951-640-8131.
Any website?
No, I don't have my website, but the McKee Real Estate Group does. We have a great website, so mckeerealestate.com.
And they'll find you there. Okay.
Find me there.
We'll be back next week.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.